Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
Jane Smiley is a novelist and essayist. Her best-selling novel, A Thousand Acres, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and the National Book Critics Circle Award in 1992. Among her other many novels are 10 Days in the Hills, Horse Heaven, The All-True Travels and Adventures of Liddy Newton, and Moo. Ms. Smiley is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. She has contributed to a wide range of magazines, including The New Yorker, Elle, Outside, The New York Times Magazine, Harper's, The American Prospect, Practical Horseman, and Playboy. Ms. Smiley, I think that's great too. Ms. Smiley's latest book is 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel, a history and anatomy of the novel as a literary form. Tonight she will speak on the novel, why there's nothing quite like it. Please join me in welcoming Jane Smiley to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Actually, I've had two stories in Playboy. The first one was a bet. A friend of mine had met the fiction editor of Playboy in the airport on her way to my house. And she said, told her where she was going. And she said, oh, I'd love to have a story from her. And so I was sitting in the living room of my house in Wisconsin. And I turned to one friend and I said, tell me about the first time you ever made love. And then I turned to another friend and asked him a different, slightly different question. And then I made these two stories that these two guys told me. They were way more interesting than I thought they would be. into my first story for Playboy, which was called Farfignugan, which, because the guy whose first episode, he was such a conservative guy, too. It was amazing. He'd been hitchhiking down the road, and he'd been picked up by a couple in a Volkswagen, old Volkswagen van. And while the young man was driving, the woman took him in the back. I said, are you kidding me? And he now works for an advertising agency. And then the next one was just out about a year ago, actually. It was called Paradigm Shift. And it was about a woman who seduces her husband into changing the light bulbs from incandescent to fluorescent. And they go on from there. The novel's really been on my mind lately because, for several reasons. I mean, not only because I'm writing one or two, but also because I've been serving as the chairman of the jury for a prize called the Mann International Booker Prize, which is a relative of the Booker Prize, but it's new. It's a young relative of the Booker Prize. But it's given out every 2 years to for a body of work. That's all they say. And then they tell us we have to, there's three of us on the jury, and they tell us that we have to come up with someone who has a body of work worthy of this prize. The first prize was given 4 years ago, to Ismail Kadare, who is an Albanian writer, and the second prize was given 2 years ago to Chinua Achebe, who is an African writer. And so we are going to give out our prize at the end of June to someone. Who knows who? I don't even know who. But they gave us My fellow jurors were two young men born in the 1960s, alas. One from Kiev and one from Calcutta. And he told me I have to pronounce it Calcutta, not Kolkata. Anyway, our shortlist, we came up with a really peculiar shortlist, which caused a big stir in England, especially, but somewhat in the US, because guess who wasn't on it? Everybody you know. But I've been reading novels steadily now for over a year. I mean, truly, 100 to 125 pages a day, boom, 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 just going through. And a lot of the novelists that ended up on the shortlist I had never heard of, and either Andre or Amit had heard of them. And so I'm going to read you the shortlist, and then I'm going to read a little bit of... a little bit of 13 Ways about the psychology of the novel, and then I hope you'll ask a lot of questions and we'll get into a discussion. So our shortlist is Peter Carey, Evan S. Cannell, and I must tell you, you all know Evan S. Cannell's famous books are Mr. and Mrs. Bridge, which are about a white couple in Kansas City, right? And the Andre, the man from Ukraine, thought these were the most exotic people he could possibly imagine. And that was a true lesson for me, because to me, I mean, I lived in Iowa, I lived in Missouri. The Bridges were like everybody I knew. But he just couldn't get over how weird they were. E.L. Doctorow, an Indian woman writer from Calcutta named Mahashweta Devi. James Kelman from Glasgow, Mario Vargas Llosa, Arnos Lustig, who's a Czech writer, Alice Munro, V.S. Naipaul, Joyce Carol Oates, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, who's from Kenya, Antonio Tabucchi, who's Italian, Dubravka Ugresic, and it took me 10 minutes to learn to pronounce her name, who is a Croatian writer who lives in Amsterdam, I believe, and Lyudmila Ulitskaya, who's a Russian woman writer. So that's our list. How many of you have not heard of at least two of the people on the list? Well, you are in for a treat. When NASA sent a capsule into space a couple of decades ago carrying schematic drawings of a man and a woman, a few mathematical formulas, some music, and several other objects, they did not include a copy of To Kill a Mockingbird. Every single novel is far too particular to be representative of the whole human race. But the paradox is that while every novel is too particular and even humble to stand as an emblem of humanity, the commonness of the novel is its most humane and human aspect. This is one of the effects of prose, one that Boccaccio pointed out in the Decameron when he was trying to justify its existence in 1350. People grow up narrating, expressing their points of view, elaborating and embroidering upon incidents, telling stories over and over. They do so because they want to fix events in their own minds and remember them by endowing them with significance and discovering their meaning. It seems clear that many species of animals communicate vocally, but no other species of animal has been discovered to tell untrue stories. Untrue stories, as Proust realized, are worth telling only insofar as they remain distinct from true stories. It is this distinction that gives them completion. We can see this effect in both lies and gossip. Lies, of course, require some sort of logic for the liar to remember them and avoid being found out. The very process of working out a lie, so it is plausible, though, is what makes it complete and implausible. Liars become smooth because they must, They are rhetoricians above all. Gossip, which is not a set of lies but a set of inferences, works the same way. A round of gossip always begins with a person everybody knows, that is a character, doing something interesting but uncharacteristic, say shoplifting a blouse. The purpose of the gossip is to add events to the story as they become known. She gets caught, she cries, she is discovered to have another blouse in her purse, the police are called, she goes to the station, her dad calls the mayor, she gets off scot-free. And to account for the twists and turns in the story by means of psychology, that narcissistic bitch, remember when she took the lipstick out of my purse and wouldn't admit it even though I found it right in her locker. And motive. She said if she didn't get that blouse somehow, her cousin would buy it, and she couldn't stand that. And then a broader interpretation of character. You know, she always has thought her cousin was prettier than she is, and she hates her for that. But you never know it because she's so sweet whenever the cousin is around. Once the story is complete, when all the events are accounted for, and the logic of the original mystery and its relationship to the character understood, it becomes boring. And the gossips go on to something else. It doesn't matter whether the story, the motives, and the interpretation of character bear any relationship to reality. Do you remember when she stole that blouse? Well, it turned out that the sales lady put it into her bag by mistake as she was leaving the store. She had paid for the other blouse anyway. The compulsion of gossips is to fill in all of the details until the incident becomes a rounded whole. Everyone acknowledges that true stories can never be fully known. Too many details lack corroboration. Too many witnesses disagree about what really happened. Every true story is unsatisfying insofar as it is required to be true. But since the novel is required to be complete, its dispensation from truthfulness, its acknowledged untruthfulness removes it from the world of consequences. The reader, suspending disbelief, expects a novel to take place in a designated game area inside a book, under rules that apply only to the game. The rules are agreed upon ahead of time. For example, that it is possible to experience a time and a place very different from one's own. However serious its subject matter, the reader suspends disbelief because a novel is a form of play. Suffering and brutality can begin and unfold without either the author or the reader lifting a finger to stop them. Horrors depicted graphically in a novel are considered to be far less disturbing than the same graphic horrors in a nonfiction account because they are being used in a different way, as part of the logical progress of a game rather than as an unwelcome or irrational intrusion upon life. And believable, happy events can also take place in a novel as a way for the mind to play over and learn from what it might otherwise not have a chance to experience. The game quality of the novel gives it meaning and form because all games begin, have a playing time, and end. It also gives the novel at least a rudimentary raison d'etre, since games are a recognized form of learning for young mammals. The author sets up the game and is required to signal to the reader early in the narrative what the rules are. He does this in part by adopting a certain diction and tone right away. In As I Lay Dying, for example, is a game about the lives of people who speak ungrammatically and are likely to do something unconventional. A Tale of Two Cities is a game in which two cultures are going to be contrasted and the contrasts are going to be marked ones. A.S. Byatt's Possession is a game in which romantic relationships and styles of literature in two eras separated by 125 years are going to be compared and contrasted. A plot game, such as a murder mystery, signals the beginning of the plot right away with some sort of sinister event. A game about the workings of the mind puts off the beginning of the plot in favor of narrative ruminations about the nature of the world. a game about seems, what seems versus what is, such as Kafka's The Metamorphosis, begins immediately describing what seems to be happening. Gregor has transformed into a bug, and this is what his little legs waving in the air look like to him. To be truly playful, a game requires voluntary participants. If the author does not construct a game that is interesting enough to participate in, the reader is perfectly free to walk away. If she stays to play, then the playful nature of the game frees her to do things she might not be free to do in life, to question, to contemplate, to fantasize, to experience intense emotions, and to feel no guilt about doing so. The participants in a game may learn something that they take away from the game, but they don't have to. This is part of the freedom of playing the game. The novel game, like the baseball game, is thus an exercise in freedom, agency, and choice. The author may attempt at every turn to imbue the reader with certain sympathies or to get the reader to believe in a certain chain of cause and effect, but the reader is always free to object or disagree, or indeed to correct the author's misconceptions, as authors of bad reviews so frequently do. The game-like nature of the novel is built on the literary convention of the conceit. A conceit is a form of metaphor or pretense. John Donne's poem, A Valediction for Bidding Morning, is full of conceit, such as, "Our two souls, therefore, which are one, though I must go, endure not yet a breach, but an expansion, like gold to airy thinness beat," in which the poet and the reader collaborate in a logical quest to understand the unique sort of love the poet and his wife share, using metaphors of quiet death, gold leaf, and compasses. The sensuous qualities of the images bolster the logic of the argument. In the same way, Trollope's novel, The Eustace Diamonds, proposes that the reader and the writer contemplate the character of Lizzie Eustace, whom they will agree to be a beautiful but shallow and ruthless young woman, who will begin the game's train of logical events by keeping for herself a string of valuable jewels that by rights belongs to the estate of a family she has married into. They will further agree that Lizzie has all sorts of relatives and associates who are implicated in her designs in some way or another, to see the effect of Lizzie's ambiguous moral choice upon the social world in which she lives. Lizzie's action works in the social body that she is part of like a radioactive isotope. As it moves around, it illuminates, sometimes in surprising ways, the moral life of the community. Trollope's conceit is that these characters and events are real, just as Donne's conceit is that love can be likened to death, gold, and a compass. The conceit of the poem succeeds if it promotes the logic of the poet's argument, and if it is vivid enough for the reader to envision it. The conceit of the novel succeeds if the reader enjoys following it out. But both the novelist and the reader understand that it is all pretense. No diamonds have been stolen. No men have turned into bugs. No radio station broadcasting wholesome pap from downtown Minneapolis was ever started by a pair of brothers named Ray and Roy. No incognito crown prince has ever pulled a sword from an anvil resting on a stone. No 15-year-old French girl was ever subjected to year after year of relentless torture and attack, and then killed by a lightning strike. That would be Justine by the Marquis de Sade. But it is lots of fun to think that all of these things have happened and more. As with all games, the novel game has many levels of play. The lowest level is perhaps simply following the consequence of the story and understanding what happens and why. Higher levels move toward greater and greater complexity and efficiency, just as professional basketball players execute more plays more quickly and more masterfully than high school basketball players do. A novel with a very high level of game quotient has more and more internal and external references, a denser and denser net of connections between words and of intuitive meanings, and the result is a higher level of abstraction. In a novel such as Ulysses or any one of a dozen other modern and postmodern novels, no character, no image, no incident stands alone. Everything is part of a network of allusions that constantly offers various meanings and reinforces the playful, you may not believe that, but the playful nature of the novel as a form. This high level of play also shapes a novel's claims to verisimilitude, in fact, making the question of verisimilitude part of the discussion of that particular novel. Novelists and readers, of course, take greater or lesser pleasure in the game potential of the novel as a form. To some readers, the various and shifting nature of Ulysses constitutes its greatest claim to verisimilitude. To others, the lack of an easily recognizable plot, which is always what makes a novel a public object rather than a private one, indicates self-indulgence on the part of the author. And as any game grows more complex, it becomes more abstract and exclusive. In order not to get lost in the subtleties of play, fans have to be highly versed in the rules and the moves of the game and willing to play the game or read the book over and over to get everything out of it. The novelist has as many drafts as he wants to enhance the intricacies of the novel. Likewise, the patient reader has as many rereadings as she wants to work out the intricacies of that the novelist has introduced. Obviously, the novel as a game gives itself over to all the tendencies of games to consume insiders and deflect outsiders. Highly referential and inaccessible novels with little plot and very complex characters need help to recommend themselves to normal readers. And so, for example, you can buy a 12-cassette course of lectures on Ulysses that promises to get you through the book in a way that makes sense of it and makes you want to read it. If you buy the lectures, which are $79, perhaps you will commit yourself to the project instead of wasting the money. The lectures and the book, it is implied, will have been worth the effort once the reader discovers the riches of the author's imagination, and in addition, the reader will have gained the prestige of reading something great, famous, and obscure. Only a novel at the highest level of play with little evident suspense requires so much promotion by those who enjoy it. Jane Austen novels, for example, recommend themselves because they work perfectly well at lower levels of play. They seem true, funny, and suspenseful, even though there is more to be discovered as the reader grows more sophisticated. The fact remains, though, that the reader possesses the novel, and so, if she finds that the residue of truth or insight remaining after the intricacies of an extremely sophisticated novel game have been worked out isn't really worth the effort, she is entitled to her opinion. So, that's what I'd like to talk about. There's one reason. As I've gone around talking about this book, 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel, I find myself saying over and over again, but the best thing about the novel is, and it's always something different. So the best thing about the novel is like 15 different things, which I could go on about at length. But there is this facet of the novel that is the game facet of the novel. That means that every time you pick up a novel, you go into a different state of mind than you would if you were picking up a newspaper. You know it's not true. You know that you expect to be entertained, or at least to enjoy, or at least to separate yourself from the world as we know it. And you expect to contemplate things as a pattern. If you think about all games that we play, just about football, basketball, dressage, chess, there's something that appeals to us in the patterns that we make, the patterns that are made in the course of the game. And So there's something in the human brain that likes to see chaos organized into patterns. The wonderful thing about the novel is that it takes, or attempts to take, the chaos of life as we see it and know it and organize that into a pattern. Can you imagine? Why would they do that? Well, because if you don't do it, life seems too overwhelming. And once you do it, then you feel like you've learned something by doing that. And so when the writer and the reader collaborate on the contemplation of this chunk of life, whatever it is, let's say the Napoleonic Wars, and the writer sets this up with a pattern in a pattern of language, a pattern of plot, pattern of character development, a social pattern, a social theory about how society works, then the two of them contemplate the interactions of all these patterns and they think, oh, now I know something. Do they know anything new? Who knows? I don't know. But their brain has changed because they contemplated this as a pattern. I always thought that I didn't even notice that before. When Hurricane Katrina came, I had about a year before read. Oh, now I can't. I'm terrible with names anymore. That's where my mind is going. I can still make the patterns, but I can't remember the names. I had read "Their Eyes Were Watching God" by Zora Neale Hurston, in which there's a hurricane that it takes place in Florida, but that's how the main characters, the main male character loses his life. It's a really terrifying and dramatic incident. And because Zora Neale Hurston was very familiar with the lives of impoverished people, it occurred when Hurricane Katrina came, that was the first book I thought of. And I felt like I had a sense of what could happen with that hurricane. And so even though I was wrong, it put me in the state of mind to ponder the lives of the people in a Zora Neale Hurston-ish way, rather than, say, a George W. Bush-ish way. So this is the thing that the longest novels and the best novelists, as I get older and become more and more interested in mature novelists, ones whose sort of way of going about their work evolved and changed over a long career, I find myself becoming interested in larger and larger patterns. So I finished reading In Search of Lost Time, 7 volumes by Proust. I called up Ed Hirsch, the poet. I said, Ed's like one of the smartest guys I know, and he was head of the National Endowment for the Arts. I said, say, Ed, have you ever read all of In Search of Lost Time? He said, well, no. I said, well, who do you know that has? And he said, well, no one. Actually, he said somebody. The person he named was the person who'd edited the book. But so I congratulated myself on reading all of Proust. But I felt after I'd read all 7 volumes that I was really much more knowledgeable about French life and the way and French psychology than I actually was, of course, but it gave me a taste for other vast novels. And so I gave up Dickens and I started reading Trollope. And if you read Trollope has a wonderful ability to sort of keep his eye on the entire civilization or the entire world that he's writing about and to change his focus. You know, in this first volume of the 6 books he wrote about the prime minister, he's going to look at this thing, and then in this volume 2, he's going to look over here, and then volume 3, he's going to look over here. But he he retains his ability to keep organized everything else. It must be why he got to be so powerful in the British Post Office, because his sense of organization was like, it's like perfect. So as I get older, this is the thing that interests me about novels, and the thing I can't give up. You know, I read all the novels for this, and then I read a bunch of novels on my own, and then I started reading the novels for the Man Booker Prize. I've read a novel every 3 days for 15 months, so, you know, how many is that? And I can't stop. I open the next novel with anticipation. I'm looking forward to it. I open it as if it were a gift, and it is a gift. And so, and I think this is the source of the gift. I may or may not, and I have to say that in the course of reading for the Man Booker International, there are people on this list who I would not date. And there are people on this list who I probably wouldn't be friends with. But I have become interested in what they have to say. I feel this connection to them, even if I don't particularly like or enjoy their sensibility. But what I've really become interested in is the pattern that they make of the world from their point of view. And my critical faculties, I would have to say, is diminished. I don't say War and Peace is the greatest book ever anymore. I don't say Marcel Proust is the greatest writer, or even the greatest French writer. I met a woman, a French literary scholar, and she asked me what French novelists I liked. I said, well, I like Proust and I like Zola. And she told me that a person could not contain Proust and Zola in one brain. And I thought, well, that's how the French are. Now I know, because I've read Proust and Zola. So I'd like to have questions, but I hope I've given you some sense of what it is that is valuable about the novel, and why we are glad that it has been invented and that we live in a absolute golden age of the novel, because we have easy access not just to the novels that are being written, but to so many novels of the past that have been brought back into print. And soon we'll have access to these novels and as even more of them, like through read on demand and maybe through electronic, like Kindles and stuff like that. And so I'm here to tell you, you can just keep reading and reading and reading, and you want more rather than less. And that's not my experience of every single phenomenon of life. So the microphone is, yes, right here, this lady in the, she's coming behind you.
Oh, hi,
Jane.
That's you.
Yes, it's me. I so admire your passion for this, and I wonder, I read a lot more nonfiction than I read fiction, and I love reading novels, but I have to, I have to be taken by it, like, really soon into the novel, it must be my judging mind. It's sort of like, nope, can't get into this, you know.
Yeah.
And I wonder how you deal with that judging mind. Do you just push through it, or do you have a certain point at which you say, okay, if it doesn't get me after X number of pages, I'm on to the next?
Well, there's two things that I think about that. One is that the novel reading state of mind is more like a meditative state of mind. And lots of people who read only nonfiction or lots and lots of nonfiction, I don't think nonfiction reading is a meditative state of mind. I think it's more direct and intellectual. And so I think novel reading is something that needs to be cultivated, and you work yourself into it by getting used to it Because it's really about suspending disbelief. Reading nonfiction isn't so much about suspending disbelief. Novel reading is about willing suspension of disbelief. That means that you have to be willing. And if you're not in a, if you're not in the habit, I was doing something in New York in a private home. I can't remember even what it was, but I described a novel that I was working on. And one of the men said, "Oh, I can't imagine reading that." And one of the women said, "Oh, I would." And quite often it breaks down on gender lines. Men don't want to read novels. They don't want to go into that contemplative state of mind. Women often do. I had to laugh. There was a profile of Ian McEwan. Is that who it was? In the New Yorker a few months ago. And he had gone out. He decided to do an experiment. He went out into a park taking a stack of novels and just tried handing them out to passersby. The men always said no, and the women always took them. And from this, McEwan deduced that he said that if women stop reading novels, the novel is dead. But you have to ask yourself why that is. Maybe the women are more interested in taking on that contemplative state of mind, but also maybe the women are more interested in the thing that the novel most openly offers, which is seeing the world from somebody else's point of view. And it might be an alien point of view. It might be an irritating point of view. It might be a wonderful point of view. But to do that is something you have to be used to and willing to do. Now, that said, there are novelists. I'll start a book and I'll put it down and I'll think, you know, I'm really not into this one. And usually I'll stop. I haven't stopped with any of the books that I'm reading for dollars, as it were, but if I'm just reading on my own, I'll stop. But I will say that one of the ones that I wanted to put down, I wanted to put down Anna Karenina, and I wanted to put down Vanity Fair. I had liked Vanity Fair when I read it a long time ago, but when I read it for this book, I was irritated by his dark, sort of cynical tone, and I hated his drawings. I hated them. But when I got to the end, I realized there really was a payoff, and I enjoyed it, and I liked it, and I respected it, and it stuck in my mind. I couldn't say the same about Anna Karenina, but maybe it was the translation. I just thought, who cares? Not about her. I did care about her. But the guy who was the stand-in for Tolstoy himself, I didn't like him. So then I decided that keeping on reading a novel that you aren't enjoying is, it's fine. You read 20 pages, you read 30 pages, you think, I don't like it, you put it away. You don't resent it. But if you make yourself go on, it's like making yourself go out with some guy that you really can't stand over and over again. And, you know, then you'll never let him off the hook. Then you'll just detest him. And it was your fault because you let the relationship go on too long. So there can be novels like that, too. So, yes, over here. There's two. Oh, I see. There's two of you. Okay. Go ahead.
In the spirit of a White House press conference, I have a two-part question. They don't relate to one another. The first one is Graham Greene used to group his books or some of his works into two categories. One he called novels, one he called entertainments.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if you thought that's a fair or a reasonable characterization. And then secondly, a few weeks before the Nobels were granted, one of the jurors, one of the Scandinavians, suggested that American novelists had nothing profound or morally complex to say. And I wonder, as a current American novelist, you think that's a reasonable observation?
Well, you know, I have to say that when subsequently they came out with the name of Jean-Marie Gustave Luclésio for the Nobel Prize, I believe I was the only person in the state of California who had read one of his novels. Oh, there is one. Thank you very much. Anybody else? Okay, only person in Northern California. Having been on this jury and read a lot of American novelists, I think they have plenty to say. Whether it's of interest to Swedes, God knows. You know, I wrote a book in an attempt to win a Nobel Prize. It was called The Greenlanders, and it was written as if it had been translated from the Icelandic. And I set out to write this book. I thought, well, it's worked for others. And so far it hasn't worked for me. But there is something about the Scandinavian sensibility that is in some sense opposed to the American sensibility. Usually there's somebody in the audience, I don't know if there is here, who has read The Greenlanders and just thinks it's really great. You know, there's always that one bedraggled person from Alberta or Minneapolis, actually St. Paul, who comes up and has her copy of The Greenlanders that she's read over and over again. So I don't know what to say about that. My experience as a juror on this, and we read the works of, I think we had 80 authors on our long list. And there are plenty of Americans, and they had plenty to say. And as you can see, we chose Cannell, Doctorow, and Oates as Americans that had appeal to not only me, an American, but you know, Andrei Kurkov, a Ukrainian, and Amit Chowdhury, an Indian. So I guess I disagree with them. And the first question. You know, after a novelist dies, his novels become amalgamated in the reader's minds in different ways. And I don't think a modern person would know which ones probably that he meant to be entertainments and that he meant to be serious novels. Because his seriousness would leak over into the entertainments, and his entertaining qualities would leak over into serious novels in a way that he didn't understand, in the way that the French lady thinks you can't have Zola and Proust in your mind simultaneously or ever together. But I see them leaking into one another because I'm outside of the French sensibility. So I think that's how we would feel about Graham Greene's novels, too. Yes, sir.
I, too, must have had a poor translation of Anna Karenina, because I put that down, but I can say I've never put a Graham Greene novel down. And I don't know whether that's because you talked about levels of play, and as a reader, maybe I play at a certain level. And I'm wondering whether a great novel or a great novelist appeals to various levels of players as readers, or whether, I mean, you know, Proust perhaps is a great novelist, but only appeals to you, for example, but not other people who read at a different level. I wonder if there's some sort of corollary between the levels of play, or if a book should be open to all players, and who can appreciate at different levels.
Well, you know, personally, I always like a novel where you know what's going on, but there are a lot of people who don't like novels where you know what's going on. They like novels where you don't know what's going on, because that depicts a sort of fractured state of mind. So I think every person's tolerance, every reader's tolerance for some things is greater than for other things. I'll never forget one year when I was teaching at Iowa State, I taught a course in the comic novel. And we had like 10 or 12 novels to read. And each student had to bring in samples of reviews of that particular novel when we were studying it. And the reviews were vicious. They were vile. That you could not believe what bad reviews some great novels like by Kingsley Amis, say, had gotten. And it wasn't just the reviewers didn't like this novel. It was like the idea of the comic novel or the idea that this novel was funny or comic brought out the deepest sort of anger that that they could summon up. So what that told me was that your tolerance for different types of complexity varies from person to person. And so I happen to like a novel that you can read on lots of different levels. You can go back to it. I think Jane Austen, for me, is a good example. When I first read Pride and Prejudice, I was younger than everybody in the novel. When I next read it, I was the same age as Elizabeth. When I next read it, I was, 5 years older than Elizabeth. Now I'm older than both the parents. And so seeing it as, I see it, a journey in the family as a psychological progress, but I see it differently as I'm older. And I see some things as more important or more tragic or more pathetic or more humorous as I get older. And so she satisfies me on the level of style and comic style and anecdote. But I also see the whole thing turning like a prism and showing me new lights. Now, I know that that's me seeing stuff into it because my experience has changed. I can't see into it what she saw it or ever that I would know. But that's, to me, another great thing about the novel is that as your experience changes, what you see in there also changes in its shape and its profundity. And what other art form, well, I guess a lot of art forms, but this is one that has such complexity to it that you can go back to some novels over and over and over again and see those changes. And it could be that I'll go back to Anna Karenina and accept the fact that Anna and Vronsky slept together without, Tolstoy describing it. But the last time I read it, I thought, I just don't believe this is a true love affair. There's no evidence here. And so I don't believe all the stuff that sort of eventuated from the love affair because I haven't seen the kind of intimacy of their relationship. They're relating like a guy would think, a Victorian guy would think they're relating, which isn't very deep in my view. So that's why I don't like it especially. But maybe next time I'll go back and I'll get what he had to say. I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know if that answered your question. Try again. Back there.
Okay, thanks. What a pleasure to talk about the novel. I just drove right to hear from Berkeley, and of course I listened to a book on CD, a novel, the whole way, and I stop at a rest stop, and it's like you don't know where you are, you're in this altered state, you're in this space of this book, and this particular novel, parts of it...
Tell me the name of the novel again.
It was the story of Edgar Sawtelle. It's a heck of a long I-5 road trip novel. It's a very long novel. And, there were parts of it that felt forced and, blah, blah, blah. It didn't really matter. I was just swept up in this whole story. And, I'm a writer, so I really love language and, nuance and all that. But there's something about story. I'll read some novels that are just beautifully written and lush and lyrical. It says on the back cover and all that. And sometimes I just get so bored if there's not that story to drive you. So I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on story, why it is I get completely lost along Highway 5, and I don't even want to stop except to come here, of course, because I'm so caught up in this story.
Well, it's probably because you're a woman. I don't know. I like the story, too. I find that for the novelist, and that's based on Hamlet, right? I'm not telling you anything new, right? Yeah. So that's a naturally engaging and suspenseful story. I think quite often for the novelist, the plot is the most difficult part. Because every plot, for several reasons, One is that every plot has some incredibly unbelievable point where the novelist has to sort of paper over that as best she can and hope that the reader is still willing to suspend disbelief. But the other thing is the plot is the organizing part of the novel. It's the string along which the events hang, and it really helps the reader to understand how to get through the whole novel. So the plotting can be very hard, and it can seem very thankless while you're doing it, because in your mind, as a novelist, your fabulous ideas about how society works, how people work, what's important and what's not important, these are what you're thinking about rather than some old stupid plot. There's only two plots. In one plot, somebody goes away, and in another plot, somebody comes. And do I really have to work this out again and again and again? And, you know, a lot of novelists have said, given up on that, and said, no, I'm going to just make it all so much nicer. I'm going to make it the way I want it to be. But the result is that then a novel that has no plot is incredibly subjective. And so you are steeped now in the author's mind with no sort of gate, no way out, kind of. A plotted novel is much more a public novel. It takes place in a public space, like a play. A non-plotted novel is much more private. So the author is inviting you in, showing you much more about the way his mind works, but you're also often more tempted to say, nah, thanks, but no thanks. Another time. So when a person like, is his name David Wroblewsky, who wrote the Edgar Sawtell? Oh, okay. Well, when he chooses to do Hamlet or I choose to rewrite King Lear, we are saying, okay, here's a plot we know works. And so this is going to help the reader get through and organize her thoughts or his thoughts. And then I can manipulate it because it's well known and find more stuff in it, find stuff in it about stuff that is more contemporary. Now, I read that book. The thing I loved about the book is it takes place in northern Wisconsin, which I'm very familiar with. And so the psychology of the family was of passing interest to me, but the landscape was really interesting to me because it's something I'm familiar with and love. Yeah, they're tragedy dogs. I prefer comedy dogs. Never could figure out what those dogs were supposed to be doing. You know, they had lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of training, very serious training, but they didn't have a real purpose in life. So I couldn't quite figure that out. But I have Jack Russells. Jack Russells are comedy dogs. They live entirely different lives from the dogs in the, even if they die, they're different from the dogs in this hotel book. Here's one and here's two.
I have the how question. You
the
know,
how?
120
okay.
pages a day, and you're writing as well at the same time?
I am.
Okay, so when do you read, and how do you balance the reading and the writing?
Well, my habit of writing has always been that it's about 2 to 3 hours, no more. I don't write more than that because I get tired. So I'll start reading, and then usually after maybe 20 to 30 pages of that day, I'll be sort of stimulated and I'll go start writing. And then I'll just come back to the reading. I usually do the writing in one go, but then I'll come back to the reading in the course of the day and then finish off sometime at night before I go to bed. So it hasn't, actually, and some of the books are very quick to read. Like I yesterday I was reading Alice Munro, and who can stop, you know? I totally enjoyed it, and I came to the end of the book, and I said, oh, too bad. So yes, there's I've managed to do them both. But I have to say, I it was only by being the tortoise, you know, by steadily going step by step by step and not ever, ever, ever deciding today I can't read. So.
I have the Hollywood question.
Okay.
I guess I haven't read To Kill a Mockingbird since I was, I mean, 20 maybe.
Uh-huh.
So and then I became a filmmaker. And I always thought that that was one of the rare novels that managed to translate really well, really faithfully, mm-hmm. emotionally to the underlying material. But I've certainly learned in subsequent years to stay away from the movies of novels that I loved or novels that are considered good, where I'd rather read the novel than see the movie.
Right.
You can comment on the movie of your book, or...
Well, there's two books that were made into movies.
Well, I'd love to hear your thoughts
okay.
on that. And but the other thing is, can you name any great novels that you think have been great movies?
I actually think great novels don't make great movies, because they are great because they make use of the form that they are in. The form of the novel... Its primary characteristics are complexity and a kind of alternation between the inner life and and action. So it's very hard for a movie to depict the inner life. and it's very hard for a movie to be as complex. Like if you went to see, if you watch those old movies or films of Brideshead Revisited, you know, with Jeremy Irons and Anthony Andrews, was it? What is that, 10 hours? And boy, they were totally faithful to the complexity of Brideshead Revisited, and you couldn't take it after, you know, session. Even Anthony Andrews didn't make it up to you after episode 4 or 5. So there's something about film that demands quickness, which is opposed to complexity. So even if they try to get the complexity in there, then you don't want it.
But like the 5-hour Pride and Prejudice really sort of works.
Well, I haven't seen that one.
Okay,
so
the 2-hour one really doesn't.
Yeah, I think it's very hard. But a second-rate novel, a sort of semi-commercial novel, often makes a good movie. Like Mystic River, I thought was a wonderful movie. And, you know, I'm not saying, Mystic River is a genre novel, and there's something about the interactions of all those characters that is really fascinating. So, to me, that's how it works, that if you want to have a great novel, it's a great novel. It's not going to be a great film, but maybe if you're really lucky, the film... can be made into, I mean, the novel, the film will make you want to read or reread the novel. Now, the second, A Thousand Acres was made into a film. They were very earnest. But they made also The Age of Grief into a film called The Secret Lives of Dentists. Hope Davis and Campbell Scott and Dennis Leary and some really darling children. And the Age of Grief is a novella, which is only, it was, I think, 125 pages. Well, that's about the same length as a movie script. And I thought they did a wonderful job with it. And, you know, I saw the movie twice. I thought, wow, that's really good. I'll go home and read the novella. I didn't even get through the novella. I thought the movie was much more fun.
The Secret Life of
Dentists. Yeah. Secret Lives of Dentists. And Campbell Scott was great. And I took my daughter to it, and I said, you know, if I'd been married to him instead of your father, we'd still be married. And she didn't punch me in the nose or anything. So I'd love to answer more questions, but the rules say no. So, but thank you for coming. I really appreciate it.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.